Blog Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones, call in, and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
Thank God it's Friday. And if it's Friday, what is it? It's Southern Sense here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your hostess with the mostest, the radio chick, Annie. And unfortunately, I don't have a co-host today. He seems to have scrammed on me. Actually, he's out doing some campaign stuff, which is good. So Cool Mike is right back smack in the middle of that fight. So we wish him well, and hopefully he'll be back with us on Tuesday. We've got an exciting show lined up. Our guest today is going to be Charles Faddis. He's got a great book out called CAFA, and found it an amazing read. We'll be interviewing him a little bit later on, about quarter after the hour. So I want to welcome everyone here to Southern Sense. You can find us up on Twitter and Facebook and Stitcher and iTunes, and it's very simple. Just go to our website, which is southernsense.webs.com. You can find a link to it on our chat page, on our show page at Southern Sense. I can't even spell. Put it in the chat room, southernsense.webs.com, and you can find us all over the place there. And guess who's joining me? Oh, my goodness, the prodigal son has come home. Good afternoon, Mikey.
Hey, Annie. Sorry, I may have to mute myself periodically throughout these meetings, but you run a campaign. There's just there's almost no time for anything, but I'm here. I did my research, and Doc Jones will be joining us later on. He's going to call in shortly, and I think we may even have Jermaine. So here I am.
Oh, cool. You know, I was doing your type of stuff yesterday. You know, yesterday I had to run over and meet with Tea Party Patriots. They're trying to open a chapter here in Beaufort County in the Lowcountry, and they're offering materials for us to work with, you know, tools that we can use to help get the conservative message out and to help get people out to vote and get informed. Very interesting stuff. Then right after that, I had to run over to the Beaufort County Republican Party meeting and show my face for a few minutes, and then race home because Annie was a stupid dummy and she ended up loading her plate on really hard yesterday. And someone called her and said, hey, listen, I need you tomorrow to cover for me and do my show for me. And without even thinking, I said yes, forgetting that I had all this other stuff going on. So last night I filled in for Dari Ann, DiGiovanni, which was interesting.
Wow.
Which was interesting, and it was on the fly. She called me the night before, and the next thing I know, I'm just scrambling, and I'm exhausted.
Oh, I can imagine. You know, I was attending a gathering, and the left wingers were out there. Get a load of this, Annie, for us Tea Partiers, okay? Here's the bad things about us. Libertarians, conservative, religious. Now, these are the bad things to describe us. Imagine that, okay? Religious, conservative, and libertarian. Okay.
Where's the gun-toting? Where's the gun-toting? Dad, throw the gun-toting in there.
Apparently, recently in my city, Grand Rapids, there is a guy to make his point. He's got a CCW. He brings his sidearm to the meeting, the city hall meeting. Well, these people brought these big signs and to the meeting, and they got thrown out because they were putting in front of the camera and all kinds of stuff. And so once they got removed, of course, all the media leaves and runs to interview these people. And she said something along those lines, what you said, you know, where's the gun? She said something like, amazing, you can't bring a sign to City Hall, but you can bring a gun. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, never, you know, you got to hand it to these people. They never miss a TV time. You know, they just,
oh,
you know, and
wow.
Of course, while they're getting dragged out, there's the one screaming, Attica, Attica. And the other one, I don't know what these people are screaming, but I'm thinking, they just, you know, I don't know.
And that person probably wasn't even born when Attica hit the fan.
No, this girl couldn't have been more than 18, 19. She was with two older ladies, one of which who I like. She's just a regular town radical, and sometimes I agree with her, sometimes I don't. But, you know, she gets involved, and she lets her voice be known. The other one I couldn't describe, other than I pretty well guess she's single because this woman is disgusting looking. But with that being said, we don't want to get off to the but just remember, libertarian, conservative, and religious. Oh, God, aren't we just the devil's advocate?
Oh, man. Well, listen, we've got a doubleheader on the dedication because I had already picked out someone and put him up on the show page. And then our guest had asked that we also make a dedication to a CIA agent. So what I'm going to do is, I don't know if you're at your computer.
I am.
All right. So I need the Army mix with this one. And the first dedication is going to go out to Army Staff Sergeant Michael H. Ollis, killed on August 28th of this year by insurgents in an attack on a NATO base in Afghanistan. And this is from the Military Times. A Fort Drum, New York soldier was killed Wednesday, August 28, 2013, when insurgents launched a complex attack on a NATO base in Ghazni Province, Afghanistan. Staff Sergeant Michael H. Ollis, of 24, of Staten Island, died of wounds sustained in the attack, which wounded 10 Polish soldiers and dozens of Afghans. It was one in a series of escalating attacks in recent months as the Taliban tried to take advantage of the withdrawal of foreign troops. Ollis was assigned to the 2nd Battalion, 22nd Infantry Regiment, 1st Brigade Combat Team, 10th Mountain Division, Light. Afghan and coalition officials have warned that the Taliban would intensify the tempo of their attacks following the holy Muslim month of Ramadan, as they try to take advantage of the 2 or 3 months left of good weather before the harsh Afghan winter sets in. The traditional fighting season in Afghanistan lasts from March until the end of October. A total of 35 people were killed, 73 wounded, in four other attacks around the country, and in the base assault on August 28th. One of the Polish soldiers was in serious condition, and Ghazni Hospital said 52 civilians and Afghan security force personnel were wounded, including 24 women and children. the Taliban's breached the perimeter, but 15 were killed in the failed attempt to overrun the base. Alice joined the Army in August of 2006. He was previously deployed to Iraq from April 2008 to May 2009 and to Afghanistan from June 2010 to May 2011. Alice most recently deployed with his unit this past January. His awards and decorations included the Bronze Star, 4 Army Commendation Medals, 2 Army Achievement Medals, 2 Valorous Unit Awards, and the Meritorious Unit Citation, and 2 Army Good Conduct Medals. And this is from the New York Post. The 92nd New Yorker to have given his life in service was Staff Sergeant Alice. Now we have fresh reason to celebrate this soldier. A new Army Time soldier story makes clear Alice's gallantry and courage under fire. His actions during his last moments on Earth speak to beautiful things, to the family who raised this young man, to the Army that trained him, and to the willingness of soldiers, sailors, and Marines to lay down their lives for another. It all happened on August 28th during an attack on Forward Operation Base Ghazni in Afghanistan. When a car bomb exploded and enemy fighters attacked, Sergeant Alice, like our firefighters on 9/11, ran towards the danger, not away from it. Among the enemy insurgents, 10 wore suicide vests. One would take Alice's life. But in what the Army Times described as emotional interviews after the attack, a Polish soldier made clear that Sergeant Alice saved his life by stepping between him and the insurgent, so that when the insurgent's vest detonated, Alice was killed instead. The Army is considering a Silver Star for Alice, one of America's highest awards for valor. People who read of Sergeant Alice's bravery may wonder, but not back home. At the funeral service for Alice, a priest told mourners, it was no surprise to anyone that the little kid who played in Army fatigues would put his life on the line to serve his country and to save the lives of men whom he served. At this heartbreaking moment for this soldier's family, we join everyone in saluting the son of Staten Island, whose actions remind us that the free air we breathe exacts a high price for the men and women who wear the uniform. The second dedication goes out to CIA agent Harold Brown Jr., who was killed December 30th, 2009, by a suicide bomber in Khost Province, Afghanistan. Harold Brown Jr., a resident of Fairfax and an agent for the Central Intelligence Agency, was laid to rest in Massachusetts. Brown, 37, was one of 7 Americans killed December 30th, 2009, in the Khost Province of Afghanistan when a suicide bomber detonated explosives at the U.S. military base there. He lived in Fairfax, Virginia with his wife of 15 years, Janet Dill Brown, and their 3 children, Paul D. Brown, Magdalena Brown, and Claire Brown. Brown, who grew up in Massachusetts, earned his Bachelor of Arts degree in Political Science from George Washington University and a Master of Business Administration degree from the University of Phoenix. He was a member of the United States Army and served in Bosnia, the Gulf War, and Operation Iraqi Freedom. He also worked for Shareholder.com and SAIC in England. According to his family statement, Brown enjoyed traveling around the world with his family and was an avid runner and a fitness enthusiast, as well as a member of the Knights of Columbus. And this is from the New York Times. Those who died came from all corners of the United States, but were thrown together in one of the most dangerous parts of the world. Several had military backgrounds, and one of the fallen CIA employees, a security officer named Scott Robertson, had worked undercover as a narcotics detective in the Atlanta Police Department, according to an obituary, and spent time in Kosovo for the United Nations. Posting on an online memorial site described a hard-charging motorcyclist with a remarkable recall of the episodes of Benny Hill's show. Another, Harold Brown Jr., was a former Army reservist and a father of 3 who traveled home from Afghanistan briefly and in July to help his family to move to a new home in Northern Virginia. Mr. Brown's mother, Barbara, said in an interview that her son, who she had believed he worked for the State Department, had intended to spend a year in Afghanistan, returning home in April. He did not relish the work, she said, and talked a little about it. The people there just want to live their lives. The normal people, she recalled saying, adding that he had told her parts of Afghanistan were just like back in biblical times. This show is dedicated to these men and women who selflessly give to our nation to protect our freedoms. We thank them and we dedicate the song to them. My Name is America by Todd Allen Herringer.
Born in the grip of oppression, I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. But when I'm attacked, I protect and defend. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. My name is America, don't tread on me. I cannot be broken, I cannot be shamed. If you hurt me, I'll get stronger, and I'll rise up from the fire. Taken from others, others gave it to me. They believe in the virtues I stand for, my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour. Because my name is America, I stand proud and free. My name is America, don't tread on me. I cannot be broken, I cannot be shamed. If you hurt, I'll rise up from the flames, and I'll always stand proud and free. I'm America, don't tread on me. America is my name. For those who need me, I'll always be here. For those who will harm me, I'll face without fear. But I'll always stand proud and free. I'm America, don't tread on me. I'm America, yes, America is mine.
My Name is America. You can download it for free at toddallen.com or click on it over on YouTube. Now, we've lost my co-host, Cool Mike, but we've gained Doc Jones as a co-host. So, good afternoon, Doc Jones. Doc Jones, unmute yourself. Okay, we're waiting for Doc Jones to come.
Yep,
there we go.
I'm here. I had to unmute myself.
Boy, do I know you.
Yeah.
All right, and we've got a fantastic guest. He's a former CIA operative. His name is Charles Faddis. He was at one point the head of the CIA Terrorist Weapons of Mass Destruction Unit. So let's welcome aboard Mr. Faddis. Good afternoon, sir.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes.
Welcome, sir.
I have gotten turned on to your books. I read the one that you sent me, and I'm going, why didn't I know about you before? Because this is exactly what I love reading. You've got a new book out called CAFA, and it's what could possibly happen if there was a biological weapons attack on us. What made you write this?
Well, it's the third book in a series, so I was continuing with the same characters, but like I do with all of these books, at the same time that I'm trying to be entertaining, I'm trying to educate people a little bit without making them feel like they're being educated. And I think that everybody who knows anything about weapons of mass destruction and terrorism believes that biological weapons are the single greatest threat to the country in the near term.
And you are using personal experience because you worked in a lot of these areas that you write about in the book, in the Middle East, South Asia, and Europe, and you actually were with the team that went into Iraq prior to the invasion and going after these WMDs. And everyone keeps on saying there weren't any WMDs, but yet I do recall, I believe it was in 2007, MSNBC did an extensive article about the removal of yellow cake uranium that being sold. So I keep on saying the weapons did this, but for some media is not picking up on it.
Well, the whole issue of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq tends to get a little complicated and be a little nuanced. I think it is absolutely true that there were not weapons of mass destruction on the ground in the way that was represented. There was definitely yellow cake. There were chemical weapons that were found subsequently. By the way, I should, you know, all of this is against the backdrop, without getting lost in the whole Iraq war thing again, that while Saddam had largely temporarily walked away from his weapons of mass destruction programs, he had never abandoned his intention to develop weapons of mass destruction, meaning that with Saddam, everything was always a matter of games and tactics, and his current tactic was to get out from under the United Nations inspection so that he could then reconstitute these programs. But there was definitely yellow cake, which is yellow cake is an intermediate stage as part of the refinement of uranium ore. In between mining it and turning it into highly enriched uranium along the way, yellow cake is one of the stages you go through.
All right. Now, on your book, CAFA, you have two main characters. You've got Aphrodite and Bill. And did you model Bill after yourself?
Wow. Well, I mean, that would depend on which aspects of Bill's character we were considering. And you'd probably get a different answer if you asked my wife. She would probably say, oh, my God, yes. Undoubtedly, there are pieces of Bill that are me. There are pieces of Bill that are what I would like to be. There are pieces of Bill that are me on a really bad day, you know, but he's also a composite of other people. You know, there's no single character in the book that was lifted whole cloth from somebody else.
So then Aphrodite's not your wife?
Well, there are definitely aspects. The dangerousness of Aphrodite is definitely my wife. So that's my wife is, by the way, a retired agency officer as well and a very skilled operative in her own right, who kept me alive on the street many times. Aphrodite has elements of that. She also draws heavily on, on characters, real life assets that I ran in the field. You know, she's attractive. She's dangerous. She's also, in many ways, kind of damaged. She's had a very rough life. She's come very close to dying. I mean, killing herself, really, in many ways. given her background. So, you know, she's a complex person, and in that respect, she's modeled a lot on assets you run in the field, where you know you're working with somebody, and it is the psychological dimension of understanding them, controlling them, being able to get them to do what you want is sometimes very difficult and very complex.
Now, in the book, you have it as a premise of an attack here on our own soil, but it was quite ironic that you used an American that turned into a Muslim and then snuck back into the United States. You know, we do have a porous border, and you were showing just how easy it was to cross.
Right. Well, the method that is used specifically by the character that you're referring to cross the southern border is an absolutely real method that is used every day, unfortunately, on the southern border. It is a methodology using ultralight aircraft is used to deliver drugs across our border all the time. And the reality is that we just don't really have in place anything that's particularly effective to stop it. If you ask the Border Patrol, for instance, you'll get a number of – they'll tell you how many flights like that they've detected. But at the same time, if they're being honest, they'll tell you that's just the ones that we've stumbled across, that we have no idea what the number are that we're not detecting. So we don't have any idea of way to figure out a percentage. One of the reasons I wanted to focus on using a character who was an American is because this is an increasing phenomenon we see, Americans that have radicalized. And also because I think it's important for people to understand that terrorist groups, and I'm talking now about Islamic terrorist groups, you know, they don't have a lot of the resources that we have. They don't have giant defense budgets and stealth bombers and so forth. So out of necessity, they are incredibly creative. And I don't mean that to sound like I'm admiring them. I'm just saying that as a fact. They are of necessity constantly evolving and creative. So whatever the methodology was they used to attack you last time, that's not carved in stone somewhere. The next attack, as fast as you figure out how they attacked you last time and erect a defense to stop that attack, all you've guaranteed is that they're now going to develop a new methodology. They're constantly searching for holes in the wire. And one of the things they're absolutely going to do is look for the guy who doesn't look like your stereotype of a terrorist, the guy who can blend in and swim in this sea.
That's a very interesting because, you know, like you said, we had Adam Gadon and several other Americans that went over to the dark side, as you'll call it. And these are people that, you know, grew up middle class. But as you said, it's the necessity that makes them mutate, I would say. And when we did the dedication to the CIA agent Brown, it was very ironic that he says that they live in almost a biblical time, meaning that it's prehistoric almost in the way they're living, yet they take us and our technology and they say, right, fine, we don't have it. We will now turn someone who knows how to use that technology against you. And it's very frightening.
Yeah. I should mention, by the way, that Harold, who you were just referencing, Brown, is an exceptional guy. And an exceptional officer, and I really appreciated that you dedicated the program to him, and I'm sure his family appreciates that. You know, the Middle East and all of South Asia, even if we're just talking about that part of the world, is an incredibly varied area. So there are areas in Afghanistan where things haven't changed in thousands of years. You know, there are other countries in the Middle East with very high percentages of engineers and highly trained individuals. But regardless of the educational level, you know, we do ourselves a great disservice if we start dismissing the intellect of our adversaries. You know, it doesn't disparaging them does not help us. They can be fiendishly creative out of necessity, if nothing else. We have seen a whole succession of basically stereotypical white kids out of some affluent suburb in the United States who end up following this path. I don't think for any particular reason. In fact, in the book that we're talking about Kapha, you know, there's some exchanges between Aphrodite, actually, and this principal character that you're talking about, who's the kid who's gone over to the dark side, where she says some pretty disparaging things to him, which, you know, sort of like, just stop wasting my time trying to explain to me what your ideology is, because you don't have any ideology. You don't even know why you're doing this. This is all garbage, and I've seen it all before. I think there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah, it's weird how that they can take people that have no direction and point them like a missile directly back at us. And, you know, here we are trying to live our just our daily lives, you know, going on kids to school, making dinner, making sure you get your paycheck in the bank in time. We're thinking of mundane things, and they're thinking of, no, let's just completely destroy them so that we can then control them. And it's a very, very, very we're actually very blind to this. You know, we just keep on going on our merry own little ways and keep letting these things happen. And your book is basically a wake-up call. I loved it. Go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, because when I was reading your book and about the delivery method of using this, I do remember a number of years ago that there was some sort of a scare about, you know, using the entrance to Disney World to disperse, you know, biological warfare. You know, why didn't you choose that method? You chose a completely different method, though.
Well, with any of these, anytime you're talking about biological agents, so basically we're talking about pathogens of some kind that cause a disease, talking about germs, the key is always dissemination, which, you know, I mean, anytime you start talking about weapons of mass destruction, you have to start talking in these really kind of sick, very clinical terms about horrific things. You know, we're talking about potentially killing millions of people. But dissemination, meaning, okay, that's great, so we've got these pathogens and they will kill people. How are we actually going to infect them with it? And this is always the issue with terrorist groups. And fortunately for us, the thing that they usually screw up. One of the ways which you described just now, made an allusion to, that is often people are often concerned about, is the idea of basically putting some kind of germs, pathogens, into air ventilation or circulation systems, which is certainly not to be dismissed. It's another possibility. I went with the method that I used in the book because I was trying to show, I think I was trying to get at the essence of how terrorists in my experience think. And I say that as a guy who worked counterterrorism his entire career, which means that you don't just work against them, but if you're going to get inside a terrorist group, that means you have to recruit members of the group. I mean, you have to turn some of them to work with you, which means of necessity you have to spend a lot of time with them and you have to crawl inside their heads in order to figure out how to manipulate this guy and convince this guy to work. So at some point you have to start thinking like them, hopefully not too much. And one of the things is that they have a tendency to cut through what we regard as very complex problems because they are completely free of the moral and ethical constraints that we operate under. So 9/11 is a classic example of that, where we're focused on hostage taking and somebody seizing an aircraft and negotiating with us. And they cut through all of that because of their willingness to sacrifice their own people, to turn, you know, to their willingness to die. And that's at the essence of what goes on in Kapha, their willingness to sacrifice their own people. And once you cross that line mentally, a lot of the complexity of the problem goes away. You realize it's not that hard as long as you're willing to accept that.
Yeah, now I've been putting up links in the chat room for everyone to click on because your book is up on Amazon.com. But you also have your own magazine, And Magazine, which that link is on the show page that people can click on and see some of your stuff. And I found your magazine very fascinating. I wasn't even aware it was out there, so I'm glad I got turned on to it. You have the United States of Common Sense. I thought that was very
right.
Humorous.
Well, AM Magazine, I won't. Ann Magazine, I'm not sure, is my magazine. I am the senior intelligence editor, and Aaron Stipkovich is the owner and the publisher. But it's a great publication. I think we're doing a lot of neat stuff. The United States of Common Sense is my piece of that magazine, and you know, I write about what I want to write about. It tends to be a heavy dose of politics. It tends to be a heavy dose of national security. But, you know, while I think I feel about the United States of America like a lot of Americans do, which is I'm not very happy with the government, and I'm not very happy with a number of things that are going on. I have infinite confidence in the American people, and I have infinite confidence in the common sense of the average man or woman. You know, I really think that, and that's sort of the central point I try to get at. You know, we look at issues and say, okay, well, I don't know, we're all tangled, tied up in knots here, but I think it's frankly looks like this is really the essence of the matter. And it's amazing how often people respond by saying, thank you for writing that because I've been thinking exactly the same thing for months.
Well, now common sense has met Southern sense.
Indeed. Mr. Faddis, I have a question for you. Now, I've not read your latest work, which, by the way, my name is Clarence Jones. I'm Annie's co-host for today. I've not read your latest effort, your latest work here, but I have read Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. I wonder if writing that book has caused you some uncomfortable exposure as a result of all the charges that are made in Beyond Repair.
Uncomfortable exposure with the agency
with the agency and with government officials or because you know I when I read works like yours and I often wonder you know this person who's writing and making these charges about a very powerful operation if they're exposing themselves to some adverse reactions from government officials or even from folks within the agency itself?
Well, first of all, just so that everybody who's listening is clear, I submit everything I write on anything remotely touching intelligence, national defense, terrorism, any of these subjects, I submit everything to the Central Intelligence Agency for clearance in advance, which is part of my obligation even as a retired officer. In other words, they see everything before it's published to make sure there is no classified information. So they clear everything, and one of the first pages in any one of my books is a paragraph from them saying that they've done that. I have never had any issue with them because in terms of clearing things, because I know where the lines are, and I don't try to play games with it, and I don't try to cross them. So I typically get articles that I write cleared in about 30 minutes, and this entire novel that we're talking about right now was cleared in about a week with not a single suggested change. In regard to Beyond Repair, which is a book work of nonfiction, as you know since you've read it, basically says we got a lot of problems here. We're not doing the job we're supposed to do, and we really need to tear this thing down and start over to be doing the job the American people need. The reaction I got to that book is the same I get anytime I criticize the intelligence apparatus, which is I get 100 old buddies from inside call me up or email me and say, thank God for saying that and don't shut up. And then the public relations agency tells me that I don't have any, in other words, the official spokesman for CIA tells me that I have no idea what I'm talking about. So what I always tell people is, as long as it stays like that, I'm going to know that I'm in the right place. The day that I will be worried is the day when the average guys doing the work are upset with me and public affairs thinks I'm doing a good job. And then I will be concerned. Then I'll check my barometer.
Well, I'm glad we got that cleared up because I'm sorry, Annie, because, you know, a work like Beyond Repair sort of puts you in a category of a whistleblower, and whistleblowers haven't fared too well of late. And when I was told that you were going to be a guest on Annie's show today, that was a primary concern of mine and question I had was, you know, how does one deal with the possibility of being labeled a whistleblower as a result of the work, and then how do you deal with it? And you explained it very well. Thank you very, very much. I have just one more question for you. Now, I'm a big fan of the television series Covert Affairs. How much of that is realistic? I had to ask.
Well, I don't know that I'm an expert on Covert Affairs. I'm very disappointed to burn notices off the air because I used to watch that religiously. Although, I mean, here's the short answer to your question. None of them are even remotely realistic, actually, most mm-hmm. of the time, which is probably why I find them so entertaining. But, you know, I mean, one of the things I try to do in the novels that I write, in the fiction that I write, is give people a little bit of a window into how this world works, particularly the world of counterterrorism. Now, obviously, with some license, because there are things that I can't talk about because they're too sensitive. And also, I'm trying to make it entertaining, so we can't write a 1,000-page book about something.
Mm-hmm.
But I try in my fiction to give the reality, which is usually, in some ways, not as sexy, grittier, even more dangerous, but not dangerous in the sense of 25-minute kung fu fights on a skyscraper. But dangerous in the sense that if you're not two steps ahead of your opponent, you're going to be dead. Violence tends to be very, very brief and very, very deadly. You know, by the time the fight starts, if you didn't know what was coming, it's too late. That kind of thing. I don't know that I've ever seen a television show, honestly, that did a particularly good job of conveying the reality of undercover work.
Understood.
Now,
go ahead,
are you familiar with Kevin Shipp and his latest book out?
I don't believe I am. What's the title of the book?
It has to do with the CIA also, and I forget what the title is. I'm in the middle of reading it, and it's in the spare office. And if anyone knows what the spare office is, that's usually the bathroom where your books are kept. But he was writing a lot about the very same thing that you were talking about the mentality in the CIA and the breakdown of the work there. And he specifically cited the Clinton Torricelli doctrine that really broke down the agency and led actually to 9/11.
Well, you know, I think my central thesis to would be this, that first of all, let's just to give credit where credit is due. None of this is to disparage the work of thousands and thousands of dedicated men and women who, despite all of these problems, continue to do amazing work and are out there, and many of whom are very, very close friends with whom I maintain contact. But what you have is an organization that has to be very elite, very lean, very flexible, has to be capable of doing the jobs that nobody else can do in the federal government, and probably more and more important every day, given the way the world's headed. And unfortunately, like everything else in Washington, the trend is to go the other direction, to make it more and more of a bureaucracy, more and more risk averse, more and more tied up in just all of the things that bog down the rest of our federal government. And it's horrible. It's frustrating for the men and women on the street. The country pays for it. I worked counterterrorism for a long time before 9/11. I know how many times we attempted to get operations off the ground to head off that threat, and how we were constantly prevented from doing what was necessary to get rid of bin Laden and al-Qaeda before we ever got anywhere close to 9/11. You know, and it's a crying shame. So my central thesis is, look, the organization is too important. It's too vital. It's too critical. It can't be just another federal bureaucracy. You gotta, You got to reverse this trend. You got to fix it. It's really important. Threats like biological weapons are not science fiction. This could happen tomorrow, literally. The last major WMD commission we had in this country said explicitly in their last report they expected an attack, a biological weapons attack on the United States within 5 years. Well, this year is the fifth year. That doesn't mean it's going to happen this year, but that gives you an idea that we are absolutely within that time horizon.
And that's a very frightening thought. And the question would be, you know, where would they hit? And I would assume it'd be a major metropolis like D.C. or New York or L.A. or something like that, because they can get maximum collateral damage by hitting a urban center like that.
Right. Well, one of the things, as you know, is discussed a little bit in the novel. I mean, I don't try to bog people down in so much stuff in these novels that the book, you know, becomes a textbook instead of something they want to read. But this issue of how fast an epidemic can spread now has received a lot of study, as you would imagine, and it's terrifying because we've had epidemics that have swept the planet before we even had steam engines. Now you have everybody moving at an unbelievable pace, cars, trains, automobiles, and aircraft. So when you start modeling this, for instance, if you show an epidemic in, say, New York, and it begins to spread in New York, well, you start to model this with computers, and what you see is that it's not just spreading out from, say, the center of New York from Manhattan into the suburbs. It is simultaneously exploding in cities all over the country and, in fact, all over the globe. Every major air hub that connects to New York is going to have somebody arrive there on an aircraft and begin to spread this contagion. And the way a disease works, obviously, is, you know, the terrorists, not like a made-for-TV movie, they're not going to call up and say, hey, we're going to spread germs tomorrow. That's just going to happen, and nobody's going to say anything. And then people will begin to show up in emergency rooms, and eventually, you know, most of that seems like the flu. Every disease in the world starts with flu-like symptoms. So in other words, it's days and days and days before all of a sudden it begins to dawn on people that we have a whole bunch of cases of this disease and something we've been attacked. And by that point, you're already, say, 72 hours behind. And people have spread not only all over the country, but actually all over the planet by that point. And so you are really, really in a race to try to catch up and to hope that whatever the disease is, you have enough antibiotics for it, you have whatever. There's a real critical window there. And if you miss it, you don't catch up. I mean, it basically just burns itself out before you catch up, and you lose huge numbers of people.
Yeah, most along the same model of the plague in Europe, the influenza outbreak in the 1920s, it just ends up burning itself out. And when you think about, when you mentioned the air hubs, you know, back in the 70s, I used to own a travel agency, and I know if you're in New York, it's going to go straight to Boston, to D.C., to Atlanta, to Chicago. It would start there and then just start spreading westward and then eastward to Europe. And it's a very frightening thought. You know, Atlanta is one of the busiest hubs here in the United States. And if you
right.
hit there, you've got the Caribbean, you've got South America it will spread to.
Right.
Unbelievable.
And you know, and depending on what disease we're talking about, now they're obviously all diseases are different and whether they're directly communicable from one person to another varies and so forth. But assuming we're talking that something that is contagious and is now being spread, it is not as simple as then saying, well, we'll give people the necessary medicine. I mean, first of all, some people will already not have been caught in time to be treated at all. But there's no such thing as a stockpile that exists of enough medicine for everyone, for every disease, or anything even close to that. You know, you could, depending on how fast you react, you could rapidly exhaust the existing stockpile of medicine. And then you're literally in a mode where we're trying to ramp up production. And you know, God, this is not an element that's introduced to the book, but God help you if it is a disease. Another concern these days is people playing with diseases and engineering, in effect, new pathogens. because if it's a disease that we actually haven't seen before, and you actually have to now go do the lab work and design an antidote, if you will, forget it. I mean, I don't mean like everyone on the planet necessarily dies, but huge numbers of people will die before you ever get that done. That doesn't happen in 48 hours. You know, that's weeks or months of work while people are going untreated.
Yeah, now that you've completely scared me, I'm going to be flying through Atlanta in about 10 days.
You know, I always used to tell people when I was chief of WMD for CIA that I really needed to get a black coat, a cloak, and a scythe and just walk around as the Grim Reaper, because every conversation you have about weapons of mass destruction always ends with this exact tone, which is everyone being very quiet and horribly depressed, and they're like, well, thank you very much. There's no point going on. I'm all done now.
All right. Well, listen, your book, I've been putting it up in the chat room, Kaffa, is an excellent read. And as you said, you don't bog people down with the details. You know, your action is fast moving and it keeps you enthralled. And when I can pick up a book and then finish it within 24 to 48 hours, I know that I picked up a good book. And that's what I did with yours. I sat down and I went straight through it. Everywhere
well,
I
thank
went.
The book thank you very much. That's the idea.
Yeah, because it drives me crazy when you're reading something and then they start getting so detailed, like the red stripes weren't exactly this type of red on the wall, and they go into every single little tiny detail, and you're sitting there screaming, get to the point. I don't care what his wallpaper looks like.
Well, I've been accused of a lot of things over the years, but having a problem with getting to the point is not one of them.
You sent me an article, and it was really quite perfect timing, because just before we went on the air, the House passed that budget that had cut out funding to Obamacare. And the article you sent me is in the Epic Times, and it's Trim the Fat, Keep the Muscle.
Right, talking about the defense budget.
And it's pure logic. And one thing I was not aware of, that we now have more 3- and 4-star generals than ever before. They're cutting out the military force, but they're doing it to the troops. But they're keeping the generals and promoting them.
Right. And, you know, again, I think I'm like most Americans, which is, look, if you're taking my tax dollars and you're buying ammunition for Marine infantry battalions or paying their pay or weapon systems that are in fact effective and are going to keep us safe, and then I'm all for that within reason. We all believe in a strong defense. When you're taking those tax dollars and you're using it to pay for bloated staffs for generals who hardly by this point have any troops to command because there's so many of them, and bureaucracy, I'm not excited, and I don't think it's okay, and I don't think that the American people think that it's okay. You know, it is an unfortunate truth, I think, that all the waste that we see in social programs and so forth has come to characterize a lot of the defense budget, and that's I was a military officer. I've worked with the military my entire life. My brother's a retired colonel. My father was a naval officer. My son is a combat wounded Marine infantryman. I mean, I come from one of those families like millions of other people across this country. So I'm all for supporting the military, but that does not equate to 1,000 admirals and generals, more than at any time in our history other than World War II, when we had 6 times the number of people in uniform.
Yeah, you're right that in World War II, there were 130 ships in the U.S. Navy for every admiral. Now there are 2.
Yep. True fact. That's how ridiculous it is. You know, I don't know if you ever read the Oz books. There were a whole series of books that followed on The Wizard of Oz.
Yes, I've read those.
Okay, so in the Land of Oz, they actually have an army. And the Army of Oz consists of, I can't even remember, but ungodly numbers of colonels, generals, field marshals. And they actually have one guy who carries a rifle, who they all order around. So I don't. We're not there yet, but we might be headed that direction if we keep up with this. You know, this is crazy, and I know because I have a, you know, a lot of contact with a lot of guys on active duty intelligence and special operations. I know that, you know, you can still be downrange in Afghanistan in a patrol base and find yourself running short on ammunition. You know, sleeping on the ground and scrounging for supplies. General Stilwell said during the Second World War, when they asked him how to fix the problem in the War Department, he said, you know, go through the Pentagon and hand every other guy a rifle and send them to the front. he was not subtle, but I think he made his point. And I think that's a very strong element of the truth now. You know, I mean, we don't need these legions of bureaucrats staring at computer screens. We need more people actually doing the work. And if we're going to start cutting the defense budget, which we almost certainly have to, then for the love of God, let's start with guys sitting in Washington, D.C., not start by taking entire battalions of Marines, who are the guys who put the fear of God in our enemies, and disbanding them. Why would you start there? Makes no sense on earth.
Yeah, it's really...
Well yeah. Indeed it makes no sense, which is why one wonders, why is it being allowed to continue? I mean, if you and I can see what's happening here, as clear as the sky is blue, at least it is here today in Georgia, why can't the president see this, or the Congress, or even the Pentagon itself? Why is it that this cycle is perpetuated? Why do we have 1,000 generals and admirals when we're drawing down so much of our military? I myself am a retired Marine officer. Why? What accounts for this? Do you have any idea? Because I certainly don't.
Well, I mean, I think it's probably a variety of factors. First of all, the unfortunate truth is that a large number of the people we have in the government, whether it's the president or, unfortunately, these days, large numbers of members of Congress, have no experience whatsoever with the United States military. So what may seem straightforward to you and I or other individuals may not seem straightforward to them, because, honestly, they don't understand anything about it. I am, unfortunately, of the mind that at least some of the folks in the defense establishment, that would include the Pentagon, are resistant to this change, have become so caught up in this bureaucracy and in this structure that they don't see that it's a problem, that they have become the problem rather than the solution. There are other elements. You know, every bureaucracy, I mean, if you cut the Park Service's budget, not to pick on the Park Service, the first thing they do is close national parks. They don't look at their staff in Washington, D.C. They don't think about ways they might be able to reduce costs. They do the first thing they can think of, and they do it deliberately, because they know that the public will be upset when you close a national park, and they will scream for the money to be turned back on. Whereas if they fired staff members in Washington, D.C. that nobody sees, nobody would ever know, and they wouldn't care. And the Pentagon knows the same thing, which is, if I get rid of 1,000 bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. and save money, nobody will give me any cash. But if I tell them that an aircraft carrier battle group couldn't sail, now I have a claim to get my budget dollars turned back on. And that sounds cold and calculating, but I think that's a large piece of it, is a deliberate attempt to manipulate people. I also think that we, you know, there is some of it boils down to having the backbone as a congressman or a senator to stand up to the Defense Department and say, look, I'm all for a strong national defense, and I fully support the men and women in uniform. That does not mean I have to vote for every dollar that you want. That does not mean I have to support chefs and gardeners for generals or any of this other nonsense.
Yeah, you make a lot of great points on that. And, you know, with this budget that the House just passed, you know, once it hits the Senate, they're going to strip out the Obamacare provision, and they're going to try to cram everything they possibly can to go back into that bill. And my question is, do you think, and I to this day, I still say Boehner has a rubber spine. Do you think Boehner will finally find the steel in his spine to just face down Harry Reid?
I'm not confident that he will find the strength. He may find that he has no choice. Look, I'm not for train wrecks for the sake of train wrecks. I'm really not for being cavalier with the federal government or the functions of the federal government or all of this. I think there is some level on which there has to be some kind of collision in Washington that fundamentally changes the mindset so that people understand that we're not doing this anymore. By this, I mean we're not just going to keep spending money we don't have. We're not going to keep just throwing money at problems. We are really going to make a fundamental change here, introduce some common sense, and yes, we're going to have to really significantly reduce spending. And maybe that the only way we're ever going to get there is by having a train wreck first. I don't know. There was an effort in the House of Representatives several weeks ago to defund NSA programs, and the NSA does a lot of good work, and I'm really not advocating that the NSA shouldn't be funded. But on some level, I kind of thought when that effort went through that that might not be such a bad thing if it went through, in the sense of getting people's attention, of saying to the federal bureaucracy and to Washington, D.C., we're not kidding. You have to start listening to the people. You can't just continue to ignore us. And if you do, we really are going to just starve the beast. We're going to cut the purse strings until you get the message.
Well, I think the up over this recently and the outpouring of we the people telling Congress we want this budget to go through enabled them to add into it that bit about the SNAP program, the food stamps, where now
right.
They're having the food stamps where you have to prove you qualify. You have to, it's also the welfare to work where the states can now determine, not the federal government, but each individual state can determine how to run their program. And I think it's a huge step in the right direction. And I think
right.
Finally Congress is saying, hey, the people are really fed up. And this isn't just a couple of people. Tea Party people out there protesting. It's people physically getting on the phone, on the internet, sending faxes, showing up at their congressman's door and saying, no, you're not doing it right. This is how we want you to do it. And I think it's finally working.
Well, and let's hope so. And I think that it needs to, people need to continue to do that. And they need to understand that that's the only way that we're going to change things is by people making noise and putting this pressure on and demanding that they get more than just lip service or sympathetic sounding phrases, but that we get fundamental changes. I mean, there are obviously very important things that the federal government needs to do that are absolutely critical. It's obvious, I think, to anybody that's paying attention that the federal government is huge, way too big, way too wasteful, way too intrusive, out of control. And we need to change that.
Yeah. Now I'm going to switch the subject just a little bit because this happened yesterday, and I think because of the advent of the 24-hour news cycle, and now people have the news right on their iPhones. Everyone can pull up anything instantaneously. This really, really caused a huge uproar. The hearings for Benghazi. Two of the parents were supposed to be testifying, and we had 16 Democrats got up and walked out during this testimony. And what really floored me was the complete disrespect they showed to the parents of the victims. But Representative Tammy Duckworth, who herself is a disabled Iraqi vet, was one of the ones who got up and walked out of the testimony. What are they thinking? What were these people thinking to give these parents and the people coming forward to testify such disrespect?
Yeah, I have no idea. I think that's them being so political and just at this point completely tone deaf. I find the entire Benghazi affair, everything that has been associated with it, to be mind-boggling. I mean, first of all, if you'd spent you don't even need to have ever touched the ground in Libya. If you paid attention to the news, you would know that Libya went through a civil war, that a brutal dictator was deposed, that the country dissolved into chaos and was filled with what we call them militias, what amount to private armies armed with heavy machine guns, mortars, artillery, everything in the world. These guys are running amok. The central authority is virtually non-existent. So now you stand up a consulate or some sort of building in Benghazi, and your primary security plan is to call on one of the local militias if there's a problem. Well, I don't know anybody who's ever spent any time in that part of the world who would have thought that that made any sense, that that passed the laugh test. I mean, the answer to that was that you would have a robust, dedicated American security element of some kind on the ground, and then probably a fully developed plan for who's coming to rescue them when they're holed up in the Alamo. But, you know, calling the local militia for help and having a handful of Americans, no matter how good, is ridiculous, was always ridiculous, was impossible. If anything went wrong, everybody was going to die. I also don't understand at all the reaction by this government. We hunt down, I'll caveat this because I'm not sure what we can and cannot say about the drone program. According to the press, we hunt down and shoot people with drones all over the planet who are involved in terrorist activity. And yet for some mysterious reason, if you were involved in attacking our consulate in Libya, you're now being pursued by the FBI, who has to now somehow figure out a way in Libya to serve warrants and interview witnesses and find these people and arrest them. Meanwhile, drones are, which to me, I think the only explanation for that is the reason is because we don't want to resolve this. We don't want to bring this. It's what Bill Clinton did when the USS Cole was hit in Yemen. He didn't want to respond, so he sent the FBI to Yemen to conduct an investigation and then deferred all action until conclusion of the investigation, knowing that the investigation would never end and he'd never actually have to make a decision.
Yeah, and the chief person behind the attack, Ahmed Abu Katala, he's with the Ansar al-Sharia, and they believe that was the main group that did the attack. He's been interviewed by CNN, The New York Times, Reuters and other news outlets, but not by the FBI. And now there was a letter to the FBI by several members of the Senate and House asking why the FBI has not interviewed, and the FBI. And what even gets me even more angry is that supposedly there was about 36 CIA operatives in Benghazi at the time of the attack, and Kerry is not allowing any of them to come forward. Additionally, they had to sign these non-disclosure agreements, but there's one guy who refused to sign it, and he's been suspended, and he's ended up getting an attorney, and the attorney has acknowledged to examiner.com that they are representing this one CIA agent who refused to sign the NDA. Now, I still don't understand, because even now, that even if these agents come forward and do testify before Congress, the NDA agreement would prevent them from actually testifying. So you're in a big catch-22.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure what additional agreements individuals may or may not have been asked to sign. I mean, they would naturally be bound by secrecy agreements in any event. But that shouldn't have anything to do – none of this should have anything to do with their actions inside the U.S. government. In other words, for them to talk to Congress, therefore they should talk to members of Congress on the intelligence committees, and obviously in closed-door settings and in settings that are, you know, appropriate for classified information. But, Congress has the power to demand that people come and appear before them in the executive branch – outside of a few exceptions, doesn't really have a way to stop them from doing that. On Ansar, so I guess I'm as mystified as you is what I'm saying as to what the hell that's all about. Ansar al-Sharia, by the way, the particular group that we're talking about that uses that name in Libya, this is not a small organization. It's not an unknown organization. It's not a mysterious organization that appeared for one day, attacked in Benghazi, and then vanished. It had staged a whole bunch of attacks prior to that. It has staged attacks since that. It's a organization with hundreds and hundreds of armed fighters. So if you're looking for a way to respond to hit them, we have more than enough information to find compounds, individuals, people. I mean, certainly as much information as we have and use to respond and attack other groups all of the time. It strikes me as just mind-boggling that we decided to turn the reaction to this attack in Benghazi over to the Federal Bureau of Investigation while we are simultaneously responding to terrorist events all over the world using military forces, special operations, and intelligence people. Why is Benghazi now a case for the FBI? Which, by the way, they would be the first ones to tell you. Their capacity to operate in a place like Libya is virtually nil. I mean, they have no authority to even go anywhere unless the Libyans let them go there. They can't serve warrants. They can't compel anybody to talk to them. They can sit around in the embassy wishing that they were able to go out and interview witnesses and waiting for some minister in the Libyan government to bother to answer their request. That's all they can do. It's a waste of time. It's a stall tactic. That's all it is. It's waiting for the American people to lose interest and lose patience and move on.
Well, I don't think that people are going to be forgetting, because there's a lot of us out there that's going to keep this up and right smack in front in the headlines. You know, this administration has a tendency to stall a lot, and they're pandering to the Muslim elements, the terrorist elements, is absolutely phenomenal, because now Obama signed that executive order to give, quote, humanitarian aid to the rebels, which we know it's not exactly food and medicine they're sending over there. So now they're aiding our enemies. I still don't understand why he's insisting on getting involved in Syria. It's a lose-lose situation, and what we should simply do is step back and see who comes out the winner and then deal with that. I don't understand what his purpose is, because I cannot understand his reasoning to go in there, because there's no direct threat to the United States.
Well, I feel like I keep saying this in regard to questions about the administration, but I'm as confused as everybody about our policy in Syria. I mean, the first thing I would say would be this: if you're going to get involved, get involved. If you're not going to get involved, then stay the hell out. He seems to have found a way to do neither one of those things particularly effectively. So I don't understand what the guiding principle is. I'm a guy who was literally the first guy into Iraq, or I guess the driver in the car and I were both in the first seat. So I'm tied as the first guy into Iraq. I'm not a big believer in rushing off to war, which doesn't mean that we should never fight. It just means that I generally think that when people start talking about getting involved in a military conflict, that the first thing they ought to do is just calm down, have a drink of water, and relax for a while. And then if they're still convinced that we need to go to war, then they need to start articulating why, what the overriding national interests of the United States are, why those can only be achieved by military force. And then if we have made it that far and we've determined exactly what our objectives are, then we're going to employ all the necessary force to achieve those objectives, meaning going in, we're going to know exactly why we're going, and we're going to know exactly when we're done and when we're coming home. We seem to do the opposite a lot, which is kind of drift into conflict with no clear idea why we're going. Then when it begins to get painful and messy, then we wish we weren't there. And the next thing you know, we're defining our objective as ending the war and coming home, not as having won or done anything in particular. So I don't, you know, by that definition, I have yet to see anybody lay out for me exactly, if we went into Syria, what our objectives would be and precisely how we would achieve them and what the end state would be. Until we could do that, I don't think we are. I mean, there are a lot of reasons I say this. Or one of the reasons I say it, frankly, is because I think when you ask men and women to go to war and sacrifice themselves and be killed and maimed, that you owe it to them morally and ethically that you have, you know, that there is a reason for their sacrifice and that you know exactly why they're there and that you're prepared to fully support them, as opposed to sending them downrange and getting them killed and maimed. And then afterward, they consider those that survive can spend the rest of their lives wondering, were they involved in something that was of value or not?
You've said a mouthful on that one. And this administration has no clear plan and nothing has been articulated. And because someone, we don't know which side, used chemicals on the populace, you can't prove which side did it, but that's not an excuse to go in. I mean, there's no American interest. We are not being threatened. You know, you've got people fighting for control of their own government. It would be the same as if, you know, we had the entire world getting involved in our own revolutionary war. You know, it's not their business. It's just between us and our tyrant.
To focus on the chemical weapons for a moment, if I may. I mean, obviously, the use of chemical weapons against civilians is intolerable. But why are we all of a sudden drawing the line of chemical weapons? This guy has been killing people by the thousands for 2.5 years now, and his father before him. So is it okay? You can machine gun people, rocket them, fire artillery and mortars at them, strafe them from the air. That's humane. But if you kill them with sarin gas, that's too much. I'm no fan of chemical weapons, but why is that the line? I mean, it seems to me if you get involved in Syria, what you've said is that you're supporting the rebels and you're ousting Assad. And that's not me saying that we should adopt that policy. I'm just saying I think that's what you're saying. And if you're saying that, then say that clearly and then adopt a policy that achieves that goal instead of this. And if you're not prepared to do that, then for the love of God, stay out and stop. And whatever you do, do not get up off the couch, make threats about red lines, get the whole world looking at you, and then back down. You didn't need to get involved in the first place, but you have now managed to actually lose credibility in the process, which is, you know, that's a cardinal sin. I mean, in a dangerous world with all sorts of adversaries, the last thing on earth we need is to be made out to be people who are idle, make idle threats. If you're going to make a threat, just like Teddy Roosevelt said, right, speak softly, but carry a big stick. If you decide you're going to hit somebody, then hit them and hit them hard. Otherwise, don't make threats.
No, and all he succeeded in doing was raising Russia's steam within the world. Excuse me. And now Putin's thinking about running for a fourth term because he feels now he's got his own nation's support. Hey, fine. You know, I stared down the nasty Americans. You know, you want me to come back into power. And that's not going to be good for us, that's for sure.
We look incompetent. Assad is, at this point, even more confident that we're not going to do anything against him. And we have somehow managed to make Vladimir Putin look like a master statesman. So that's quite an achievement. I mean, not a good one for us, but that's really a stunning series of accomplishments. When we really could have avoided all of this by just not making these threats in the first place. I mean, if you decide not to get involved in a fight that's none of your business, people really don't draw much in the way of conclusion. It's just not your business. You start making threats that you're going to do something and then walk away without carrying them out, you are not back in the same position as you were. And I'm not trying to transform foreign policy and national security into the third grade playground or something. I'm just saying that, you know, there are really dangerous people and organizations out there, and they monitor this kind of thing. I remember how many Islamic extremists I've talked to over the years who talked about how when we left Somalia after the Black Hawk Down incident, how emboldened they felt. Because all they took out of that incident was, we ran away. That they didn't get lost in why the hell were we in Somalia in the first place or any of this. All they got out of it was we ran. And that for a lot of people, that will be all that will be absorbed out of this lesson, is that Barack Obama made a bunch of threats, acted like he was going to do something, and then didn't do anything at all. And we will feel those repercussions. There will be real-world repercussions.
Absolutely. And all we end up doing is putting our own men and women who volunteer for service in harm's way. We've got a couple of callers that have been holding on patiently. This one gentleman is a fellow BTR host. Thomas, you're on the air live with Southern Sense and Charles Faddis. Good afternoon.
Hey, Annie. How are you guys doing today?
All right. Do you have a comment or a question for our author, Charles Faddis?
Yes, I actually have a comment and a question. I'll make it quick. When I went to school at ITT Technical School, I was our librarian there was from Iraq, and her husband's dad had been murdered by Saddam Hussein. Anyway, I asked her the question, and this was my question to her, and she said, I said, people in America say that we went over there for the oil. And I said, is that true? Why are we there? And she said, her first comment was, American people are stupid. And then her second question to me was, do you know what yellow cake is? And at the time, I had no clue what it was. And she was talking about the uranium ore, actually. And she said, truth of the matter is, American troops were over in Iraq actually securing the stockpiles of uranium ore that you never heard about in the news. Could you kind of speak to that? That's what I want, if you knew anything about that from your time in Iraq, or if you can't speak to that.
Right. We touched on this briefly earlier.
Oh, okay.
Yellow cake is an intermediate form of uranium in between when it's mined in its raw form and, you know, several stages before it becomes highly enriched uranium, if that's what you're doing. There was a fairly significant quantity of yellow cake that was found in Iraq. It was rounded up. It was secured along with a bunch of other miscellaneous stuff. For instance, a lot of radiological materials. In other words, things that aren't good, they are not useful for making nuclear weapons, but they're highly radioactive and they're dangerous. They could be used in dirty bombs and that kind of thing. So a lot of that kind of stuff was policed up and taken care of for a period of time before it could be moved. It was secured in country. So that's true.
Wow.
Okay.
All
right.
Thanks, Andy.
No problem, Thomas. We got a Skype caller on the line. Let me bring this individual in. Skype caller, you're on the air live with Annie and Southern Sense and our author, Charles Faddis. Who am I speaking to?
Oh, is that me?
Yes, it is. Skype caller.
Oh, wonderful. Can I ask you a question? You say you worked in the CIA.
That's correct.
Right? You're familiar with the author... I forget his name. It's going to come to me. Perkins, who wrote The Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
The Confessions of what? I'm sorry, of an economic hitman?
Yes, of an economic hitman. What he claims is that the U.S. manipulates the rest of the world through coercion, money. We set up the dictators, we tell the dictators as long as they do what we want them to do, we'll leave them be, they can do what they want, we'll give them the money that they need to do what they need to do, but as long as they do their bidding. We had plenty of that. We had Saddam Hussein, who did our bidding for a while and then decided that he no longer wanted to do what we wanted to do. And then we took him out, and we put somebody else in there. But one of the comments that Perkins made, and this is what I want to address to you, one of the comments that Perkins made was that our intelligence is so bad that we don't know what's true or not true. In other words, there's so many lies going through the system that people who don't know the big picture, they only see pieces of it. and the pieces of it that they see may be lies, yet they're working in intelligence. So how can they protect the country if they don't have good information? In other words, nobody can protect the country because nobody has truth. In other words, some people are acting upon the lies.
All right. We'll let Mr. Faddis answer that, Charles.
Well, you know, look, it is certainly true that at various points in our history, we have, out of some perceived necessity, supported some folks who were not particularly savory. Whether that was right, whether that was wrong, whether we should have done it, you know, that's a case-by-case analysis. The quality of intelligence is a huge issue. You know, particularly human intelligence, it's difficult to acquire. It's, you know, when you're a spy and you're working sources, huge quantities of what you're being told is a deliberate lie. Huge quantities of what you're being told is not a deliberate lie. The guy thinks it's true, but he doesn't have any idea what the hell he's talking about. And every possible variation in between. So it is a sea of shades of gray. You know, how do you navigate that? You navigate that by having very savvy, very experienced, highly trained personnel, by having really rigorous processes, by comparing information from multiple sources, cross-checking, all kinds of things. It takes a lot of discipline. It takes a lot of professionalism. Part of what we were talking about earlier in the show in the book Beyond Repair is my argument that we are not making that quality, that we are not getting to that grade, where our human intelligence is often not of sufficient quality, and, you know, particularly in cases where we're relying upon a single source. You know, that's a very scary thing. You're relying upon one guy and you can't cross-check his information. That's typically a prescription for disaster. Some of that is what happened to us in Iraq.
Well, okay. Charles, this show has gone, we're down to our last 3 minutes. It has gone so fast. It has been fascinating. And I do highly recommend your book, Kaffa, to everyone out there in the chat room and that's listening in. You can find it on Amazon.com. Do you also have a link to it on the magazine AND magazine?
Absolutely. If you go to AND magazine, if you go to the United States of Common Sense.com, which is my portion of that, absolutely, there are links on there. If you go to my company website, which is Orion Strategic Services, there's a link there. Easiest way is just to go on Amazon, Kaffa, C-A-F-F-A, and you can find all of my books there, actually.
And it's a great read. It's a very fast read, and anyone who likes this type of stuff, the spy stuff and the adventure, you'll pick it up and you will not put it down. Charles, I thank you so very much, and I definitely would like to have you back on again.
Yes, ma'am. You tell me when, I'll be here.
Okay. Well, I got your number. I'll be talking to you. You enjoy your weekend.
All right. Y'all take care. Bye-bye.
All right. We will be back again on Tuesday, and our guest Tuesday will be Congressman Mark Sanford. He'll be joining us on Tuesday, and the following Friday we will have a candidate for Congress, for Senate, Derek Grayson. He's out of Georgia. He's a minister, and he will be joining us, and he's running for the Senate seat out of Georgia. So we hope everyone will join us back here again on Tuesday. So please have a safe and healthy weekend, and we'll see you again. Like I said, same bat time, same bat station on Tuesday. Until then, good night, and God bless to you all.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up and trouble
you. You've been listening to Southern Sense Blog Talk Radio. Producer and your hostess extraordinaire is Ann Ubelis. The theme music, American Stand Up, is written and performed by Don Fortney. For more from Don, check out his webpage, teapartymusic.webs.com. Southern Sense is a proud member of Ghost Fighter Radio and Freedom Media Network. Southern Sense is common sense. Take it out, Don.
American
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will,